Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Are you struggling to understand why fear drives our decision-making in high-pressure situations? Then don't miss my video lecture, Why Fear Makes Us Say Yes When We Knew We Should Have Said No. As a therapist and an educator, I delve into the psychology of fear-based compliance. Whether you've experienced it in cults, controlling relationships, corporate cultures, multi-level marketing, really anywhere, learn how skilled manipulators get us to override our instincts, silence our doubts, and say yes when everything inside wants us to say no. Discover how we fear being labeled difficult and the psychological mechanisms that keep us complying with others' demands. This lecture and many more are available for purchase on my website, rachelbernsteintherapy.com. Just follow the link in the description of this episode to view and purchase all of the available lecture videos. Take good care. Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have a special guest. We have Chiaki Yanagimoto. She is a Japanese-born, Los Angeles-based producer, director, and founder of Cinepic Entertainment. Her first produced feature, Samurai Avenger, The Blind Wolf, in 2009, became a cult hit, pardon the expression, launching her career with a series of festival favorite genre films. She then shifted gears to produce documentary features, including Kampa, For the Love of Sake, and Kampa, Sake Sisters, which had its first premiere in San Sebastian at the San Sebastian International Film Festival, and distributed by IFC Films Sundance Selects in the U.S. Chiaki made her directorial debut in The Cult at the End of the World, which premiered in the U.S. documentary competition at the Sundance Film Festival and was distributed theatrically in North America by Greenwich Entertainment just in 2025. She founded Cinepic Entertainment in 2017, and as a unique multicultural creative force, her work in the industry extends well beyond producing. In 2022, Cinepic launched Saka, a film distribution service dedicated to bringing Japanese independent cinema to global audiences and supporting Japanese filmmakers on the world stage. She's currently producing a slate of international documentaries and scripted films. I had the honor of being involved in one of the screenings of about the Om Shinrikyo cult, and was able to help to moderate the Q&A after the showing at the Lemley Theater here in Los Angeles. Chiaki is a wonderful filmmaker and a wonderful person. And here she is now. It is such a pleasure to have Chiaki Yanagimoto with me today. It's so nice to see you again. I was treated by you and Ben Braun to be able to help with the Q&A for the showing of your movie, which was a really fun experience, actually. Shout out to the Lemley Theaters also, while we're at it, because they love to support movies that I think are truly important, that are not only entertaining, but they're message movies. And there are not a lot of theaters still wanting to really support that and back that. And so, yeah, I want to make sure to mention them. It is a really wonderful thing to have you on to talk about the movie, but also you and what motivated you. So if you don't mind just taking a few moments and introducing yourself, and then we'll start talking.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very excited to speak with you today. Yeah, so myself, I was born and raised in Japan. I've been living in Los Angeles for 20-something years. My main thing is producing films. I do work in a sort of like a larger capacity in anything that's film related or video related. between Japan and US. I do go back and forth between Japan because I work with a lot of Japanese filmmakers or producers or business people there. Yeah, so I've been producing films for the past 15 years or so. And the most recent one I produced, but also co-directed, which is a documentary film that you just mentioned, The Cult at the End of the World. That was a great experience for me because I've been working as producer for years, but director is a whole another experience. I really, really enjoyed it.
That's wonderful. And Om was in the news many years ago, and then we didn't hear about them, and people will sometimes forget. We have sometimes short memories about things that happen, especially things that happen in other places, but that there is something that I think I really learned. I mean, many things, hearing from people who had been in it, the families who were affected by it, people trying to report on the story and follow it and how they were treated. But that there was this sense that there was this feeling like a visceral response to the awfulness of it, that something was happening in this beautiful bucolic area, you know, in the mountains. And it was something very evil, very ugly, poisonous, literally. And so when that happens in your backyard, so to speak, it can absolutely impact you. It's almost like having someone who breaks into your home. It just changes that lovely naivete that you want to have about where you live. And so for you to be able to talk about the feeling in a country when something like this happens was something that we didn't have a sensitivity about, I think, in the rest of the world. So I'm wondering, from your perspective, what led you into wanting to cover this story and then what you realized? I mean, we're going to talk about cults and indoctrination and all of those things, but also what you noticed about truth, about being able to get the truth out, people being able to uncover things, people being silenced. I mean, there's so much right now that I think people are getting to be more aware of about how much access they have to information and how much they don't. So it's interesting on a lot of different levels, the silence and the deception that goes along with that kind of silence, or being able to keep people silent. And what we also learned about Shoko and, you know, his personality and how he did what he did and how he got to be so powerful. So yeah, I'm curious from your perspective, what you remember about the feeling there when things went down, so to speak.
I think you nailed it, that the whole incident or phenomena even, not just single incident, but the fact that this group existed and did a terrorist attack on the nation, on the citizens of Japan. I think that was really, really traumatic. It kind of happened out of nowhere, but it was happening in front of our eyes, in front of our public eyes. And it's something that we can learn a lot from. And I'll go back to my memory of when it happened, but when we try to make this film, or as we were making this film, we realized as a team, we realized there's a lot that we can learn from this incident, not just for Japanese people, but for really people who live in modern world, especially right now. So I think Om is almost synonymous with the sarin incident in the Tokyo subway in 1995. It was a deadly attack on citizens of Japan in the morning when the busiest time in the subway system. It killed many people. It injured thousands. Mostly, it really traumatized people of Japan. When it happened, I was still in middle school. I lived in a place called Yamanashi, which is a beautiful countryside of Japan, close to Mount Fuji, or where Mount Fuji is. When it happened, it was, of course, huge shock to the nation. Itself is a huge incident, but also for a short period of time, we didn't really know what was going on. This is a time where there was internet, but there's no social media. We were glued to TV for news. Shortly after the incident, we all learned that this group, Om, is behind this terrorist attack. Om had the largest headquarter in Yamanashi, where I lived. So although my house wasn't next to this group's headquarter, there was a period of time where Yamanashi was associated with Om headquarter. It's just a countryside, so we don't really have many things to advertise. We have Mount Fuji, but Mount Fuji was for a period of time associated with OHM's headquarters because it was right at the foot of Mount Fuji. So there was a time when I remember when I was in middle school, there was a time where parents would tell us, don't go near. If you see people roaming in the mountain in white robes, be careful. Psychologically, it was a very traumatizing period, especially for people or kids who lived in Yamanashi at that time. And then, of course, it kind of expanded to, oh my God, like this group actually was the group that we were seeing on TV for many years. They were right in front of us, our eyes, on the election campaign and many phases that led up to the incident. So I think that itself was a really shocking thing for us. And when you said it happened in our backyard, it was the Japanese conducting terrorist attack on Japanese. So I think that's also part of the reason why we don't really talk about it, because it's such a stigma. I don't want to compare it to 9/11, but for many terrorist attacks around the world, it is usually us versus them. For OHM case or for a subway sarin attack case, it was us versus us. So it was unique case. It also, I think, is a unique case because it happened in Japan. I think in Japanese culture, traditionally, there's a social sort of expectation that you don't really talk about something bad. There's a saying that if it stinks, put a lid on it. So there's a culture of if it's not something you're proud of, just don't talk about it. So for many reasons, it wasn't really talked about, especially really the core story of the OHM phenomena. I think the incident itself is on news every March 20th, and Shoko Asahara is, but on the surface level. As filmmakers, we wanted to really deep dive and talk about what actually happened.
Also, just about getting justice. I mean, yes, there is a whole shroud of secrecy, privacy, not wanting the world to be in on what's happening there, and that if that's also cultural. And at the same time, sometimes things exist in the shadows because they're able to exist in the shadows. And bringing a light to it is actually really vital. And then I think that really led to there being justice in this situation with him and some others going to jail and then put to death, actually, for his crimes, which is unfortunately all too rare. Not that I want people to die, but just the idea of there being some level of justice. It doesn't happen, I think, often enough in situations where people are really taken advantage of. And I also wonder about the idea of your people fighting your people, that really it's like, I don't know if the rest of the world necessarily would see it that way. I think they would see it as a sociopath against your country, the malignant narcissist against your country, not necessarily Japan fighting Japan. I could see why it might be seen that way, and then it might be something that might bring up cultural or countrywide shame. But I'm also thinking what it was like for you at that age to be hearing about people in white robes roaming around the mountain. I mean, that is the stuff of nightmares for kids, just that image. You have to beware, not go into, it's like the dark forest kind of a feeling. I'm sure it was very freaky.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a nightmare for kids, but also for parents. The large part of it is like, you don't really know what it is or who they are or what they're actually capable of, what they're actually doing behind curtains. I guess not a lot of people have experience of living next door of a cult, but also at the same time, like in the modern world, you don't really know what's going on. And when you pick something suspicious or something dangerous, and when you know there's an evidence to it, you just don't know what else could happen. So at the time, I wasn't, I guess, mature enough to really like try to understand. I was just scared and I wouldn't go near the mountain or I wouldn't go near danger. But also for the parents who understood probably much more what actually happened, was terrified, I'm sure.
Right. When you start to hear certain stories of people doing things to other people in certain places, it can instill a fear in you. And I'm sure taking the subway didn't feel the same.
Yes. When we started showing this film at film festivals and also, of course, in New York and LA and here in the States, a lot of people who lived in Japan at that time or whose parents lived in Japan or in Tokyo at that time came up to us and started sharing stories. I think if you lived in Japan at that time, if you lived in Tokyo at that time, you always kind of have a story of, oh, I almost got on that train, or I was working and I heard something about something and missed the train, or my train didn't come and I wasn't really sure why. You always have personal stories. My dad could have been on the train kind of thing. Yeah, I'm sure for those people like who really lived through it without really knowing. I mean, there were a group of people who knew exactly what was going on. There were a group of people who knew exactly what was going on because they were in the group. There were people who knew that something that scale would happen because they knew the group. And then majority of people who are public citizens who have no idea what was going on. So for them, I'm sure it was traumatizing experience, and I'm sure they didn't really enjoy being on the subway for a long time.
No, I'm sure not. It's also reminding me of the 9/11 stories that you heard a lot. I remember I was living in New York and I had come back to California just a month before this happened. But I remember checking in with people after, and it was those stories. I was going to be on that plane, or I was going to be in that building, or my cousin is there, or whatever else. But people were feeling like it was a near miss for them, and they don't know, by the grace of whatever, that they weren't affected. But then there is this tragedy, and then an awareness of what can happen if a group is going unchecked, if there are not enough safeguards. So people hope that this causes people to develop, and countries to develop, more safeguards. Sometimes, again, because even the country itself sometimes has a shorter memory than the victims would want. But I'm wondering about you wanting to really cover this story, and also what we need to know about Shoko Asahara and just that personality, and what you learned about how he was able to do this and really get people so enamored with him and pretend to be something that he really wasn't inside. What was your motivator for wanting to cover this, and then what we learn about him?
In terms of motivation to cover this, I mean, for me, it was a obvious motivation of wanting to find out what actually happened. Because in my memory, as I said, it was just an incident, and then there was a group. And then, of course, every year, when it comes to March 20th, which is the day when the subway attack happened, TV covers it. We see on media, oh, this was the subway attack, and Shoko Asahara was the culprit, and Ohm was behind, and Shoko Asahara was the leader of this cult, blah, blah, blah. But that's all on the surface level. As an adult, when I look back, I realize I really didn't know who Shoko Asahara is, but also who these people in Ohm were, and what actually happened, and what was that election campaign that I do remember seeing election campaign on TV, but I was so little. It was just silly people doing silly things, dancing and singing on TV, and that was that. And so to me, it didn't really make sense that those people were ended up doing the terrorist attack, and I just realized how little I knew. So that was the motivation to cover it in a medium of documentary film. And in terms of Asahara, as I said many times, it's on TV, and there's also TV specials, and they depict Shoko Asahara as a monstrous cult leader, which in part is, of course, true. He is responsible for manipulating his followers to do horrifying things. But also at the same time, he is sort of a creature of a lot of cultural elements, socioeconomic elements of Japan at that time, a little bit of a upbringing, a childhood experience that he had, a little bit of a disability that he had. His persona was born because of many elements. And there's, of course, a debate of nature versus nurture. Was he born as this monstrous character, or was he the result of many other things? And I think that's one of the things that we tried to go a little bit deeper in the film, because I personally thought that whatever you see on TV, on the TV special or like 10-minute news, that's not really what it is, and that really doesn't help us. So part of the goal was to really go deeper into who this Asahara Shoko was, who this cult leader was, it was a great experience talking to people who lived at that time, who saw Asahara evolve, sort of. He was, of course, also a father figure to the followers of Aum. But also at the same time, he was an empty character, I felt. He himself, of course, has a motivation, but he was surrounded by a lot of skilled people, talented people, intelligent people who he was able to manipulate successfully. Yeah, it was a really interesting character observation of who this person, who I thought I knew because of TV specials, on the deeper level that goes back to his childhood.
So interesting. Right. This whole piece about his childhood, which is, I really am kind of fighting with myself here because I want to tell people what was in the movie, but I also want them to see it. So I'll just speak generally, but please see it. It is so, it's so good. And it's such a powerful avenue to get the story across, but also to honor the people who were directly affected by this and to understand their experience, which is, I think, so important. But yes, he had a very difficult childhood and was made to feel a lot of things that I think he was trying to heal as he got older. And it begs this question of, yes, it sounds horrific. No one would want to have to go through that level of, I don't know, feeling empty or feeling rejected when you're young. But as you get older and become an adult in the world, it is true that sometimes people will give someone else a pass. Like they'll say, well, we just need to understand that they went through this hard time and not give them a hard time. Because I do think it's an explanation, but I don't think it's an excuse. So there is still this level of responsibility that you need to take. It's like people who are almost afraid of finding out that their spouse, who might not be so kind to them, has a disorder. So then the spouse can say, well, that's just my disorder. You can't be mad at me. I can't help myself. Well, at some point, to be able to say, even if I can't always help myself, I still want to get some help with this so that it doesn't impact thousands of people in deadly ways. It's an interesting thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the explanation and excuses are different. And in order to explain things, you really need to understand. And today in modern world, information society, there's so many information that pass by and you think you know, but you really don't know. I don't want to like judge this world by headlines. And a lot of people, I think it's not their fault, but a lot of people see the headlines and they kind of move on and goes back to sort of like, oh yeah, that's that. And that becomes an excuse. But to really understand and to really explain, it requires you, us, to go deeper in story. Of course, we don't have time to go deeper on every story that happens in the world. But also at the same time, I think it's a responsibility to try to understand what's behind the headlines. And that was a little bit of a thesis for this film as well. You really need to try to understand what actually happened beyond what the headline says.
Okay. And watching the footage that I didn't see growing up, but people will see by watching your film about the political party, running for office, the dances, the masks, the whole thing. You have to see that. It really is, it's amazing. Because as I was watching it, I was thinking, there's no way they're going to win. How is that going to go? Probably not well. But that there was this feeling, I thought, it was like this sinking feeling of, oh no, he's so out of touch. And he's stepping on his own toes here by having things come out that are kind of laughable. It's not going to go well. Because of his personality, he's not going to be able to handle that. But it's like he set himself up. And it just shows sometimes how out of touch people are who almost have to develop their own world in order to feel like they can live in it. They can create their own society because they don't know how to be in the world outside. At least that's what I got from him when I was watching your movie. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, the election campaign is, as I said earlier, you know, I remember seeing it on TV. And at that time, it was just something silly. And just as a kid, it was something that was fun to watch people with masks and dancing. But I think you're absolutely right that it's easy to be out of touch when you have followers surrounding you, telling you, oh, you're the best and you're my father figure. You are capable of everything and you're the king of the next generation, that kind of thing. It's just human nature. I feel like not everybody, of course, is in that situation or can be in that situation, even if they wish to be. But it's just the human nature when you're in that position. And I'm not giving excuse to Asahara, of course. But when you're in that position, when you're successfully putting yourself in that position, it's just so easy to be out of touch.
Yeah. And I often think of cult leaders as being people who would not be able to be in the real world. Like they often don't have marketable skills. They wouldn't survive in the wild on their own. Like their superpower, unfortunately, is to control and to find the people who they can enlist to do either the dirty work for them or to be the brains behind the operation. And it feels like that's really what happened here too.
Absolutely. That's what the cult is. There's a leader who has an idea for certain things, ideology for the world, and people who support that ideology and support that sort of the utopian world follow him and support him, do everything for them. Again, I don't want to give excuse to those people who had followed and listened to Asahara and ended up having done crime. But at the same time, it's just how the cult is structured. And again, going back to the point I made earlier, we really have to understand like what was going on in their psyche and in, you know, what was also going on in the world that supports or accelerate that kind of thinking for the followers. In the case of Ohm, it had a lot to do with the bubble era, we call it, of Japan, sort of materialistic world of everything is going well and people are making money. There's things in the world. And at some point, young people started thinking like, what am I doing? They started pursuing psychological satisfaction or they seeked other ways to be satisfied in life. And that became something spiritual, and Asahara happens to be doing yoga school, and the whole, there are a lot of line that connected many dots at that time, at this very specific time, a very specific economy.
Right. I think how cults got very big here in the 70s and 80s, probably for similar reasons, that people were looking for something that felt more grounded. And I guess when you find something that's so different from your life, and if your life feels superficial or empty, and you're looking for something with depth and meaning, you might not question it. You might just think it's safe and good because it's so different or because it's using spiritual language. And it's really good to ask whatever questions you can. At the time, though, in the 70s and 80s, it was very hard to get information. There wasn't the internet, and it was hard to connect with people who had left organizations because there wasn't a place where they were talking online, and people were so disconnected and isolated. And so now people are a lot luckier. And even though there are a lot of cults that will do their recruiting online, unfortunately, so it goes both ways.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting debate because does social media help or hurt more? I think there's a lot of ways for misinformation or made up image of what you're looking for. It could be spread a lot faster than 70s, 80s, or in Ohm's case, 90s. Is it a better thing or not in terms of when you look at how people can find those information or people can be educated, but also people, it's not really being educated because they find what they want to find. So is the algorithm better or worse in terms of people trying to find something that fills their void? Do people question more or less because of social media? I think that's an interesting debate. I don't have an answer to.
Yeah, no, it's one of these, it remains to be seen kinds of debates. But it is true. It's both, I think, really, to a great degree. And so many religious leaders can just behave like influencers. They can have a following. And people also think that they just look that way all the time, like influencers. And they don't realize this was their 50th take to get it just right. And you can be very polished. It's so true. there's so much deception involved.
Yeah, it's interesting because influencers are, for the lack of a better word, like a mini cults, not necessarily in a negative way. It is a group of people who follow one individual or a couple individuals blindly. So I'm not saying that's the influencers that are working with bad intention, but I'm just saying I think the followers, I mean, it's literally called followers. Influencers have a lot of power over people.
Oh, they do have a lot of power. And sometimes it's fine. It's buy these shoes, whatever, something.
It works in a really great way, too. I listen to a lot of podcasts or YouTube videos. I guess they're not really influencers, but it's really easy to access wisdom and what you're looking for. So if that's doing positive things to you or to your friends or to your family, then I'm all for it. It's a little bit of a scary idea that people who have power can do many things, good or bad, to influence people.
Oh, yeah. I'm very glad actually you brought up the word family, because that was something else that I found very interesting about your coverage of what happened, that families were really torn apart and their kids were stolen from them. And I'm sure that kids at the time would not have called it that, and the leader would not have called it that, but that is what was happening. And so I'm wondering about that, about the idea of him being this father figure, of that being their new family, and what you noticed there, and how much control then he was able to exert, and the families that you talked to who had to deal with not knowing where their children were.
Family, I mean, in many cultures, but also in Asian culture, in Japanese culture, families is the core of life. The family bond is for generations. Yeah, in Ohm, as you mentioned, there were many cases where parents and children were separated. Children were sort of brought up in their own world and environment. And then, of course, they had different education than the rest of the world. And for them, after the incident, after the sarin attack, and after the group itself was dissolved or forced to be dissolved, a lot of children were rescued. They had really hard time assimilating themselves to the society because they didn't have, first of all, education, but also they didn't really have the similar idea of family compared to other kids who grew up in Japanese society, the rest of Japanese society. So there's a whole lot of articles and researches on the kids who grew up in the cult in Ohm. This March was the 30th anniversary of the sarin attack. And I read a lot of articles about what those children's life look like now and have looked like in the past 30 years. Our film, our goal was to understand how the subway attack, or what happened until the subway attack, and what really like led up to the subway attack. So our focus was on that. So naturally, we couldn't really allocate the time in the film to really depict what had happened 30 years after. To cover Ohm's story is a challenge because there's so many elements that's relevant to our society now. Our creative decision was to focus on how it happened and what led up to it and how the society allowed this group to grow and do this horrifying terrorist attack. So our film doesn't necessarily focus on how those kids tried to live in the society after they left the group, but I would encourage everyone to find articles and study because it's really heartbreaking, but also it's really something that you can learn a lot from. Learn a lot about human psychology, learn a lot about how society actually works, how society see people with certain stigma, certain history, certain family background, and have a fixed opinion about who they are, which is in many cases not really who they are. It's a really interesting research. But yeah, at that time, before the subway attack, when the Ohm was functioning and when there were hundreds of people in the compound, families were separated, and it's just something that you can never gain back. Yeah, it was a very unfortunate situation for those kids, but also for the parents too, because they were blindly following this leader.
Oh, it's very interesting. I hadn't even thought about the stories that would be coming out 30 years later and what life was like for people coming out of that situation. Oftentimes when people are involved in things like this, they don't understand what was really happening. They might not be privy to all the information. They know what was happening to them, but they also don't know why. They don't know how to answer those questions. And sometimes people will expect that they'll be sort of cult experts or human psychology experts. They just know it was a very weird thing, or they were mistreated, or something unpleasant happened, or they have kind of a moral injury around it. Like they feel guilty about the pain that they caused their family, even though it wasn't their fault. There's so much of that usually.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate situation because, of course, some kids were born into it. Parents were there in the group, and some kids were literally born into it, and some kids were brought into the group when they were 3, 4, 5, like really, really small. And of course, for them, they don't know what's going on. But also for the parents, and I want to be clear that the terrorist attack was conducted by several people in the own group. A lot of sort of high rank officers were directly involved in the terrorist attack and many other horrifying crimes. But majority of the followers, I would say sort of like a lower tier followers, they had no idea about the crimes that were going on. They were just there to blindly follow this ideology of Aum and follow Asahara. Again, I don't want to give excuses to those people who probably hurt the families and the kids and family around, and of course their own parents who objectively saw the group and saw the danger of the group. And a lot of parents at that time try to save their kids from the group because they knew the danger of Aum. A lot of followers in the lower tiers didn't really know about the crime. And of course, for them as well, after the group was dissolved, a lot of them didn't really believe in the fact that Asahara and other people were responsible for the sarin attack. But after they learn, or after they realize, or after they come to understanding that, yes, this was conducted by these certain people, they also had felt guilt, even though they weren't involved in those crimes. They had to live with it. And going back to the kids, I think in any society, if you meet someone, let's say in their 30s, and they say, oh, I was in Aum, or I spent 10 years in Aum, I spent 5 years in this another cult that's widely known, how would you feel? And I think that's the answer. You always see people through a certain lens, but in Aum's case, the kids, especially kids, don't represent what the group was at that time. But in Japan, everybody has heard of Aum. Everybody has seen what they done, at least on the surface level. I'm sure it was a painful experience. Having your own family, having your own kids and facing society in your 30s and 40s, I cannot even imagine going through that as someone who was born into the group. And it's just an unfortunate situation.
Yeah, it is unfortunate. When I talk to people who were born and raised in groups, or even some who got in when they were very young, before they really formed a self, it's basically like being born and raised into it. It is very disorienting to be in the world. They will also sometimes have a lot of anger and resentment about having been brought up that way. So there's a lot of emotion. And then their parents will sometimes feel the need to take responsibility for it or distance themselves emotionally from it, sort of whatever they can handle. I'm wondering just about the numbers for a moment, how big it got and what years it was around and for how many years. What are we looking at here?
The group itself is, of course, known mostly for the sarin attack, which was 1995 in the 80s. Shoko Asahara, who is the leader of Aum, formed a small yoga group, and that was really how it actually happened or started. He formed a spiritual group or yoga school in 1983. The yoga group was a success because a lot of young people at that time, especially college students or intelligent people who were seeking spiritual satisfaction, they started going to this group, and the yoga school expanded and became larger. And Asahara, I don't want to give a spoiler in the film, but Asahara saw a chance and he changed it to a religious group in 1987. And while he does that, he started marketing the group, and the group just kept expanding. There were thousands of followers by the time it hit 1990. But even before 1990, smaller crimes started happening. But of course, majority of followers were not aware of all these crimes and murders and kidnappings that were happening. And I think around 1990 is the time small groups of lawyers and journalists started finding there's something wrong. There's something wrong about this group. There's something dangerous about this group. All those kidnappings and murders that seem to be happening around this group, there's something about it. That's when really a small group of journalists and lawyers started fighting with this group or try to uncover what actually was happening, to little success, because the public started showing this group as somebody who's silly, and the group started being on TV and talk shows. And early 90s was really when they flourished in the public's eyes, because they had election campaign and they were on TV. They were just small celebrities in terms of like how they were depicted on media. And then that group really expanded internationally as well in the early 90s. And then by the time the subway attack happened, which was 1995, there were tens of thousands of followers around the world. And there was office in New York as well. It wasn't big office, but it wasn't like a big following in New York, but there were followers all around the world. In 1995, when the subway attack happened, and soon after Japanese government ordered them to dissolve, the scary thing is on surface they dissolved, but they still exist in different name, smaller scale than 1995, but they still exist. The group itself, or the Asahara followers, still exist in Japan.
Incredible. Yeah, I remember hearing about, because of the work that I do, I remember seeing an article about, is it called Aleph?
Aleph, yes.
That's very interesting. I mean, when you see that a group starts to have its own tentacles, like it's branching off, it can make it hard for people who have really been harmed by the group to feel safe again, thinking, well, it all depends upon who's running it and what their intention is and how they're going to use it or misuse it or abuse the power. So it can cause people nervousness. Are there people watching out now for some of these groups just to see what they're up to?
Yeah, absolutely. So after OHM was ordered to dissolve in 1995, the Japanese government has been monitoring all the activities of this group, Aleph, and a couple other groups that are splinter groups of OHM. And a lot of the background of how OHM grew and became what it became had to do with the partial lack of power by authority to really investigate religious groups. And so the government made an effort to change that system, change that philosophy. And that philosophy itself is tied to another historical event in Japanese history, but you just have to watch the film for that. But yeah, Japanese government has been monitoring Aleph and other splinter groups. Every quarter, Aleph has to submit reports of how many followers, how many offices, the assets, what the activities are, everything. But because of the monitoring system, Aleph, I think, failed to submit those reports a couple times, and the government has the power to limit their activity. So, for example, now, I think Aleph has missed a couple reports on time. The government ordered them, you cannot recruit people, and you cannot do this and that. So the government has been monitoring by reports, but also physically, there's police presence around some of the offices that they have. And when we made this film, of course, Aleph is a big part of this whole narrative and what we learn from this phenomena, but it wasn't really, I guess, worth the risk of approaching them and try to talk about what happened before 1995.
Wow. It's reminding me of something that I see a lot with cults, with people who are abusive, people who are manipulative, who are manipulative partners or bosses, when that organization or that person gets into trouble, they don't necessarily learn to have a conscience suddenly. They sometimes will hone their skills to see how they can get away with it better by not doing those things that got the group or the person in trouble before. That's when sometimes you know who you're dealing with. They're not going to have this internal sense of, oh, we really wronged these people and what we're doing is bad. But let's see if we can figure out how to be more clever and just keep going with it. And yeah, those are people often who will not be safe to deal with. And I'm glad that you didn't put yourself in harm's way for, I don't want to say for nothing, but for nothing that really added to the film in a substantial way, what you were trying to cover. That's actually, I think, really good thinking.
Yeah. Also, it's not like nobody's looking at them. There are a lot of journalists and researchers and lawyers who are actively studying them. So as filmmaker, it didn't serve the part of the story that we wanted to really go deeper. But of course, there are a lot of articles and there are a lot of studies done to Aleph.
Okay, so I'm wondering also if you did feel, it was interesting because I was going to ask if you ever felt in danger with doing this story and with talking to certain people. I would imagine as someone who is doing film, who wants to be able to report on things and investigate things, if you're interviewing people who say, oh, I was a reporter, but then I was threatened, or I was part of the law firm where something bad happened to me or they broke into my house, I can imagine having a moment and thinking, okay, now I'm nervous.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're not the first person to ask, because I got a lot of questions, or a lot of people, especially Japanese people, have approached me because they know how dangerous they were at that time. And of course, being able to conduct terrorist attack that killed people. So of course, a lot of people came up to me and like, did you feel the danger? Like, was it dangerous? Like, are you in danger? I would say there were maybe two times that I felt a little bit, not in danger, but I felt maybe the danger was around here. To be honest, I think I felt danger the most when I started this project because of the memory that I had. Of course, it's the same memory that a lot of Japanese people have. The sarin attack, they killed people and they kidnapped people. So I think that was when I was, I guess, nervous the most. As I started speaking to the journalists and lawyers who lived at that time, who fought with the group and who lived and who sometimes, in some cases, got threatened by this group. As I started speaking to them, they know a lot about how the group is monitored now and how the group was the product of a lot of elements at that time, socioeconomy elements and cultural elements, all those stuff, and how different today is. I feel less and less nervous. It's actually funny because, as you said, like, I should feel more nervous because I'm exposed to a lot of stories of like, oh yeah, I got threatened by it. I got almost assassinated by it. But the more I learned, I felt calmer, I would say. Of course, I have been aware of the potential danger that looms. And of course, we spoke to a government agency called PSIA. And they are the government agency that monitors Aleph. They have a lot of data. They have a lot of information. We did a whole interview with them. And actually, before the interview, this organization was one of the first organizations that we reached out to with the intention of talking to them and getting their blessing, but also to getting their support and access to information. They were really, really helpful because their goal is to make information available to the public, so that the danger of Aleph doesn't spread. It's not only them, but I should note that a lot of people that we spoke to, the journalists, the lawyers, the support group, there's a crime victim support group who was probably the very first organization that we reached out to, and they were super supportive. They really supported our goal of, we want to understand more of like how it happened so that people can learn and study and this same thing doesn't happen again. So we got their full blessing. They were super, super supportive. One of their representatives is in the film as well. Anyway, so PSIA, this government agency, has given us interview, and we learned a lot. We got a lot of information, access to a lot of information. And the more I knew, I felt calmer that I wasn't in immediate danger. I knew that they are severely monitored, actually. But I would say that, and it's not going to be a spoiler because he's in the trailer as well, but we spoke to Joyu, who was sort of like a number two in the group at that time. And he is one of the few, very few people who didn't get executed, who didn't get severely punished by law. Again, you have to see the film to know why. When we went to interview him, was probably the moment I felt the most nervous in the production, because again, I had a memory of him being on TV, defending the group pretty aggressively. The whole public was talking about him like, oh, he's a liar. And he's not somebody who's been hiding. He has his own YouTube channel. He has his own study group. You can look him up. You can kind of see how he lives right now. He has an X account. Of course, did some research before interviewing him. And I think because of the strong memory that I had from my childhood, I was pretty nervous going into that room. Of course, there were people. We had camera crew. We had producers and sound crew. His office is really tiny. So we were sort of like this, and he was right in front of me. And I think just on the psychological level, it was pretty nervous. But also, I should say that there are two police officers right in front of his apartment. So I knew that we weren't in danger because the police officer is right there, and he greeted us when we went in. And he asked us many questions because he wanted to understand what we were doing. We knew that if something happened, he would be right there. And if we don't come out in a couple hours, then he would be there. So I didn't feel any physical danger. It's just on a psychological level, I was pretty nervous that day.
It is such an interesting perspective that I think people don't necessarily think about, that when someone is being filmed, you just see them, but you don't realize there are lots of people all around and someone who's just a few feet away from them. My goodness. And that was you, and among other people, but just the bravery, I think, just to be in a small space. I think it's chilling. The interview itself was chilling to me, looking at it psychologically and watching his face. Someone wants to be able to see a case study in someone who doesn't present themselves in a way that feels consistent, like they're kind of giving hints and tells about certain things, but their words don't necessarily match what their faces do. It was so, it was one of the most powerful parts of just exploring the psychology of people involved. And again, I don't want to give too many details, but I want people to almost experience that.
The way he portrays himself on film, not only Japanese people get it, but I think a lot of people in the world can see how he portrays himself. And in a way, he was exactly what we imagined, but totally opposite of what we imagined. So he's a really key character in the film. And of course, in the story of Ohm as well, because he joined the group really early and he became number two of the group. So without his interview, I don't think this film was what it was. I am aware of potential criticism of giving him platform, but he has his own platform. He has his, as I said, YouTube channel, X account. He has social media, his website. He has study groups that he teaches and he shares what he's teaching on the internet. So it's not like we are giving him platform, but we wanted to incorporate his side of the story, really, because he's the only survivor who witnessed this from inside. So without his interview, this film, we weren't able to give depth to the study of this phenomena.
Oh, absolutely. You were certainly not glorifying him, but I think you probably just needed to make him feel safe and comfortable to talk to you and not be confrontative, to allow him just to be and reveal himself in a lot of ways, which was really important.
Exactly.
Was there more that you wanted to be able to say, or the takeaways or messages that we learn from things like this?
Yeah, I would say for me, as someone who grew up in Japan and who has a certain clear memory of the subway attack, but also how Ohm was portrayed in media, I learned a lot about what actually happened, what actually allowed them to expand. And that part was really a lesson learned for me. And really talking to a lot of journalists and lawyers who were witnessing the group at that time and were trying to warn the public, warn the media, warn the police how dangerous they can and how their voice didn't reach widely. I think that was a really interesting study and something that I felt relevant to today's world. When we started the production at the end of 2019, the world was a little bit different and we just started this project purely as observation of how it happened, how this group became what it became, how this small spiritual group could ever become this international terrorist organization who can conduct terrorist attack in the Tokyo subway. And then, of course, this film is not political, but we saw the surges of QAnon and Capitol attack in the US. And that happened as we were shooting this film. It's not just particular group, but the psychology or the mentality of cult and mentality of people following certain individuals blindly, that was certainly more relevant in today's world, not just in the US, but in Europe and in many parts of the world. So I think it unfortunately ended up becoming a film that's very relevant in today's world. Naturally, there's so much that we can learn from. It is a very specific story of a group in very specific country, very specific era, in very specific economy. But for some reason, 30 years later, there's just so much that we can draw a line and not draw a line, but there's so much that we can learn from. Unfortunately, it became that lesson, but I just would love a lot of people to watch it. It's not just the story of Japan. It might look like it, but I think a lot of people can see the relevance and see what we could do to be better and make sure the same thing won't happen. Domestic terrorist attack wouldn't happen, which does have consequences. And the film is available now in America online on streaming. And I'm happy to say that we have a Japanese release secured. So I can't say the date now, but we have a Japanese distribution team who's working right now. So I'm very excited for the Japanese release. It is, of course, very different experience, I'm sure, to share this story with people in Japan. But yeah, I'm very, very excited.
That's amazing. Congratulations. I love that.
Thank you.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Whenever it is coming out, let me know. We'll announce it. There are people who do listen from Japan and people who have family in Japan and people who are directly affected by this group or might be part of one of the splinter groups. I mean, this can really be relevant for a lot of people, but it is like a case study of so many things. And also of this perfect storm, unfortunately, that sometimes happens. And there's no way to control that. But what I also really liked about it, it's the same thing that I kind of like about shows or even podcasts or whatever else that talk about cults, where there wasn't a focus on the followers having something wrong with them or being gullible or being weak in some way, which is this way that the public sometimes sees people who get involved. And instead, there was really the focus on him, as it should be. It's like when people say they were with someone abusive for a lot of time, the focus goes to the victim. Well, why did you stay? Really? That was your first question? Like, I'm going to be criticized for what I did in response to someone else's behavior. I like that you put the spotlight in the right place. And also that it showed how people can get away with things and how people made a lot of justifications and excuses and turned a blind eye because it was then religious. And so we don't want to seem intolerant. And I think people just didn't want to feel like they were attacking some religious organization. And so they were able to get away with it for far too long.
You're exactly right. And I'll add to that, that there were many horrifying things that were happening inside the group as well. How the top group sort of forced the lower tier followers to live and be trained and be punished. But also, we didn't want to scandalize this film. Like, we didn't want to put a spotlight on those horrifying things inside the group because, I guess, in a documentary world, of course, there'll be people who will be glued to it for that. But at the same time, we won't really learn things from the horrifying things that was happening at that time to a specific person. And we wanted this film to be a study we wanted to step a little bit further back and look at the society and what we focus on how the group grew, but what allowed this group to grow. As you see in the film, that's again available on streaming now, there's a lot of media, police and public, and there are a lot of elements in society that eventually, unfortunately, out of intention, helped this group to grow. So that was our goal. And I think I'm glad that you think that we put the spotlight at the right place, because yeah, we certainly didn't want to just make this a series of scandalous things and be done with it.
Yeah. Where can people find it? Where can people connect with you if they want, or if you want them to reach out? And also about the support group that you mentioned. I would love to be able to put a link to that. If they're open to people contacting them, that would be a good resource too.
So there's a OM crime victim support group that is in Tokyo. They're really focused on supporting and making sure that the victims of the OM crime are supported in society and financially. And I think they're really focused on that. The film is accessible on streaming in America now on Amazon, Apple, all the major platforms. I don't really have a social media presence, but I'm sure if you see the film and if you go to our distributor's website, Greenwich Entertainment, all the information should be there. I really hope people would tune in and experience the story.
Yeah, thank you. It was beautifully done. And just hearing you talk about the process and what it was like for you, and also as a child, and that part about how when you started, you had fear coming from that middle schooler place, that childlike space of fear of the unknown, of this very creepy sort of just don't go out into the woods kind of feeling. But then, right, I think once you move into your role and you see also that there's some safeguards in place, so you don't feel that way.
Exactly.
Just staying in your house so you're not attacked, I mean, that doesn't really feel like a safeguard. I'm really glad that it wasn't torturous for you throughout the process. That's very good.
Yeah, it's a horrifying story, but I really enjoyed the filmmaking process because it was a really personal lesson. And personally, I learned a lot, and I had a really great experience talking to these journalists and lawyers who I knew at that time because they're on TV. Shoko Egawa, one of the journalists, female journalists in Tokyo, is sort of like a hero to me. She's just fantastic. It was just such a pleasure talking to them, talking to a lot of other people. And Ben Braun, who's a co-director of mine, he's fantastic to work with. I really, really enjoyed working with him. And also Keita Ideno, who's a great editor. It's a documentary, so, you know, editor does a lot. I really enjoyed working with the whole team, Summary Entertainment, who's the producer of this film, fifth season, who's financier of this film. I really, really enjoyed it. I hope people who watch it enjoy as much as I did.
Yeah, it manages to be such a difficult thing at times, seeing the footage.
Absolutely.
That you brought it all together and brought the human part of it, really talking to people. And yeah, I'm sure it's fun to meet your heroes too in the process. I'm glad you had a chance to do that. Yeah, the people trying to report this and get the word out, they're brave soldiers in this as well. Thank you so much, Yaki, for your time and for the contribution that you've made to cult education, prevention, but also doing something that I think heals a nation in a lot of ways, gives people a chance to find out what happened, why it happened, but also what happened to the people who were affected by it then. People like to know. So I'm sure it helped to answer a lot of questions for people. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you again for having me.
One more thing before you go.
It was so interesting to be able to speak with Chiaki. I think that one of the things that really, really gets me about people who work hard to really bring stories to light is that they get involved. They get involved in the stories and they get involved with the people and they care. They care about the subject. They care about the people who are affected by the story. So while they have that kind of sensitivity, awareness of people's experience, especially
documentary filmmakers, there's also something really unique about talking to a filmmaker who lived this, who was raised not far from where the Om Shinrikyo cult had its very creepy, nefarious buildings at the base of Mount Fuji. When you look at this film, and please do, it is really interesting to see the encroachment and also how groups can get away with this for so long. It was also a very interesting show of the limitations of the media at the time to really pursue a story. They could also be intimidated out of it. But a lot of people will make space for things that they consider to be spiritual organizations or religious groups. I had a recent experience with going to a free outdoor concert here in Los Angeles. And I noticed that one of the vendors they have had a big tent and it said The Way to Happiness on it, and they were passing out material. The person in charge of the event at the end said, hey, before you leave, please check out the tents of our vendors. Check out and see what they're doing. The Way to Happiness is an organization that really cares about people and really wants them to have a good life. Well, anyone in this field knows The Way to Happiness is the name of a book that was written by L. Ron Hubbard, and it's become the name of one of their sub-organizations. And so here, this organization where I saw this concert outdoor, and they put on a lot of events in Los Angeles, was doing advertising for Scientology. And when I called to let them know that maybe they wanted to just do their research about what The Way to Happiness was, I wasn't telling them what they should do. Just look into it. I got a call back saying, from the woman, that she was offended by my call and that she doesn't discriminate based on race and religion, is what she said, even though neither of those have anything to do with this situation. And I thought, that is interesting. I wouldn't go so far as to say that she's a Scientologist, but just that a lot of groups get away with a lot of things because people don't want to touch what they think is spiritual or religious. And they think that they're going to be a bad person for doing it. So it keeps people, I think, silent at times, and it keeps the powers that be from being able to protect the public. And so I think that what I have found also so interesting about this story, about the leader of Om Shinrikyo and about the history of him, Shoko Asahara was someone who had, and it was detailed in the movie, a very troubling childhood. But as I talked to Shiaki a little bit about this, you'll find over and over again when you hear these kinds of stories that people will say, well, I can understand why this person had these needs and I can understand why they behave a certain way. And people make justifications for people like this in relationship. They went through wartime or they lived through abusive childhoods, or they were neglected, as Shoko was. At the same time, while it's an explanation for where some of their behavior comes from and where some of their illegal, immoral, sociopathic behavior comes from, it is not an excuse for it. That's on the adult later on to say, you know what? The things that I am doing in my life actually hurt people, actually tear families apart, actually put people in danger, might even cause them to be ill or to die. And while I could continue to blame my childhood, I also need to take responsibility for this. It is also true that some of these early childhood experiences do affect brain development, which we're going to be talking more about at a future date on this podcast. And so some things can be mended and sometimes some can't be. But I do remember, and I'll never forget, actually, there was a client of mine who came to me and he said, I need to talk to you because I have narcissistic tendencies and I'm also a very compelling speaker and people feel for me right away and they follow what I say. And some of it could be the way I was born, or some of it could be out of survival, that is how I survived in the system that I was in, the family I was in, where I wasn't given what I needed. And I was up against actually a narcissistic parent, and I had to figure out a way to matter. So I found ways to study people, to learn what made them tick, to have them think that I had the answer all the time. I could snow teachers, I could manipulate situations and get the grade that I wanted. And it actually scares me. And that part was incredible. It actually scares me. I know I can do this. And I know I can take it in directions that are not ethical. And that scares me. And he really actually wanted some help with undoing those parts of his personality because he knew that he could use them in unethical, immoral, and dangerous ways. That's a rarity, but it's possible. And it let me know that was possible. When you have someone like the leader of Om Shinrikyo who started to become, I think, more and more ill over time, didn't care about what he was really creating or doing, and then was putting many people in harm's way, many people at risk, doing lifelong damage to them and to their families. At some point, what you want is for him to be able to step back and say, this is actually not okay. But again, that's all too rare. Some people don't want to step back from the power they've accrued because then they worry they will be nothing, that unless they have all of this, they simply will implode. They will not exist anymore. And so it is very important, I think, for people to be able to have eyes on people like that. And for documentary filmmakers, for people who tell stories, for people who explore stories and expose stories, like Tiaki, to be able to continue doing this work so that we understand that personality, we see the impact, and we also get kind of a cautionary tale about how little the legal system, sometimes the police force, the media will do to really expose it because they're afraid of being seen as bad people if this is, again, a spiritual organization. There are many organizations that start out under the guise of spiritual organizations but are really anything but. And all it takes is a little bit of digging. And I'm so glad that people like Tiaki do that work. So, thank you so much for listening today and for getting a chance to learn about this documentary film and about the process of uncovering and really exposing and seeing the truth. Take good care. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.